The History of Literature podcast is a member of the Podglomerate Network and LitHub Radio. Hello. In a fallen world, what does it mean to describe people as they are, not as we wish them to be? That question has bedeviled scholars of Niccolo Machiavelli for 500 years. Is he a refreshing realist whose advice is based on practicality and pragmatism? Or is he a diabolical schemer, the dark priest of propaganda and manipulation and means being justified by ends? We revisit the life, works, and reputation of Machiavelli with guest Gabriele Peduglia today on the History of Literature. Okay, hello everyone. Here we go. Let's get straight to it. We've got a Machiavellian scholar. Well, let me rephrase. A scholar of Machiavelli who will tell us about the framing that he adopted in his book on Niccolo Machiavelli, published by Columbia University Press in their Core Knowledge series. And we'll hear from, let's see, who would be a good my last booker for this one? How about Sarah Rudin? Keep things close to home, and by home I mean Italy, my beloved second home. She was our expert in Virgil. We'll hear what she has to say about her choice for the last book she will ever read. But first, a couple of stories I wanted to share. I was home alone last weekend. My wife took my son to visit her mother, and I had to work. So it was just me in the house, and there's something clarifying about having that experience when you spend most of your time living with others. Suddenly, your choices are 100% your own. What will you do with that time and that freedom? If it's been a while, you're not sure exactly what to expect. And it's not just what will you do, but who are you at this point in your life? I know who I was when I was in Taiwan, aged 22, living alone. As it turned out, I was a guy who most days bought dumplings to eat from the market below my apartment, and then who holed himself away with a big pile of books reading on my mattress on the floor. That was what I chose for myself. This time, decades later, I had a similar choice for a little while, a little window of choice, and I ended up eating some leftovers and watching a bunch of movies. First, I wrapped up the last 20 minutes of Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, which I started a few weeks ago for some reason. I remembered that movie from the theater as being almost impossible to watch. It was so disturbing. That worm in the ear going into the brain. I couldn't believe they even showed it on the screen. Is this legal? Well, things have changed since I was 11 or whatever I was then. It was a little like returning to your elementary school and finding that the lockers have shrunk down to miniature size when they used to be soaring towers. The movie is pretty tame. And don't worry, I'm getting to the stories. Next, I went straight to some old musicals because I think I was maybe a little lonely and wanted to cheer myself up. It's not easy dealing with the sudden quiet of a house. The absences were starting to loom large. So I filled the house with Singing in the Rain and then Guys and Dolls back to back. And along the way, I was reading about the films because I'd see an actor I recognized and I'd go down that rabbit hole or I'd wonder, well, whatever happened to that guy? That kind of thing. Little research projects while I was waiting for the popcorn to pop, let's say. Here are my two stories. The first comes from Singing in the Rain, and the unbelievable scene at the end with Gene Kelly and Sid Charisse. Oh my goodness. I did not appreciate Sid Charisse as much as I should have. Oh, what a dancer. I knew the name. I knew she was associated with dancing, and I had seen this movie before. But this time, I was floored by her, her grace, and her sexiness, and her power. Oh, Sid Charisse. And then as I was doing my little rabbit hole research into Sid Charisse, I found this quote by Fred Astaire, who loved dancing with her. They did some incredible work together. And Fred Astaire said, "When you've danced with Sid Charisse, you stay danced with." Kind of a perfect quote. And then Guys and Dolls. I enjoyed spending some time with Marlon Brando and Frank Sinatra, of course, and Nick from It's a Wonderful Life. He's there. Accent a little toned down, but basically the same character. And the songs carry us along, or carried me along. By now, it was getting late. I had added a cocktail to my coffee table. I wasn't quite singing along, but I was bobbing a bit, not ready to jump up on the table and add my dance moves to the night, but maybe ready to tap a toe or two. And this time in my rabbit hole, I started reading about the female lead, Jean Simmons, whom I did not know anything about. She was born in London in 1929, and now that I know her a bit more, I'm sure I'll recognize her in a bunch of things. She was in Great Expectations, the classic David Lean movie. That's on my list to watch again soon. Oh, I forgot to mention, speaking of David Lean, after I watched Wrath of Khan, I watched David Lean's Brief Encounter before I got to the musicals. And that maybe that's why I turned to the musicals. I need something a little bit happier to cheer me up. But that movie, Brief Encounter, is as stunning as ever. That's the best one of all four movies that I'm mentioning today. Do check that one out if you get the chance. Okay, back to Jean Simmons. She was in a lot of movies in the 40s and 50s, and she married the movie star Stuart Granger, and the two of them went to Hollywood to star in movies there, and her contract was sold to Howard Hughes, of all people. Howard Hughes, the weirdo billionaire. Well, I don't know if he was a billionaire in actual dollars, but probably a billionaire in today's dollars. He had that level of wealth and that level of weirdness to go with it. Howard Hughes is the villain in the story. He wanted to have a sexual relationship with Jean Simmons, his newest starlet, under contract. That's an ugly idea, isn't it? When he kept pestering her about it. And finally, Stuart Granger told him over the phone, "Mr. Howard Bloody Hughes, leave my wife alone or you'll be sorry." But Hughes didn't stop there. Jean Simmons had the chance to star in a movie with Gregory Peck, a little movie you might have heard of called Roman Holiday. But Hughes, angry, refused to loan her out to the director, William Wyler, who was eager to use her for that role. Instead, Wyler had to cast then-unknown Audrey Hepburn, and the movie made her a star. That could have been Jean Simmons' part, but Hughes, vengeful and villainous, would not let her do it, and he was not finished. He put her in a movie directed by Otto Preminger and starring Robert Mitchum. Mitchum, I hope you all know Robert Mitchum. He's one of my favorite old-time movie stars, and he was Roger Ebert's absolute favorite movie star when good old Rog was growing up. He's kind of a, I don't know how to describe him. He's kind of a serious Bill Murray, maybe, dramatic Bill Murray. He's got that coolness and nonchalance and unpredictability of Bill Murray, but in the service of some tough guy roles and some hang. He's got those droopy eyes like Bill Murray. He seems like he does not care, which is very appealing. Terrific actor. So, back to Howard Hughes, who was still furious at Simmons for rejecting him. So he told the director, Otto Preminger, to treat her harshly on the set. And Preminger did it. He's villain number two in this story. And there was a scene where Mitchum in the script was supposed to slap Simmons, and Preminger kept urging him to slap her again and again, repeatedly and harder until finally Mitchum turned and decked Preminger, punched him, and said, "Like that? About that hard?" And that apparently saved the day. I love that story because it seems to me that we are too often in our own cocoons of our individual cocoons of ego and self-preservation and general helplessness. We don't help those in need as much as we should. It would have been very easy for Mitchum to shrug and say, well, this is my job. This is my career on the line here. If Hughes and Preminger want this, who am I to say no? They pay me. They could end my career or at least make my life difficult. And instead, he said, just what kind of infernal game are you playing, sir? Well, I'm not going to play it. Bam. You want me to hit her? I'll hit you. Which brings us to Machiavelli. Maybe that's not fair to Machiavelli, because we're not dealing with only one side of Machiavelli. We're not just viewing him as the do whatever it takes to get what you want kind of guy, although there's definitely some of that in him. Hey, you want power? I'll tell you how to get it and keep it. And sometimes it won't be pretty. But hey, you didn't ask me how to be good or virtuous. You asked me how to get power. Sounds like for you, being good or virtuous is not your goal. Mitchum, no doubt, had a goal of being a star and staying employed by the powerful people who could make that happen. The director, the owner of the studio, but he wasn't willing to do whatever it took. Somewhere in there is a lesson for us. In a world of Machiavellis, now and then, we should try to be a Mitchum. Gabriele Peduya, our guest today, might challenge this whole concept. He might say, well, the world is full of Machiavellis, but not the Machiavelli as he's been handed down to us. Who was Niccolo Machiavelli? How should we think of him today? We'll look into that after this. Hello, everyone. This is Jack here to tell you about a way to eat better and easier. That's right, Factor, and their delicious, ready-to-eat meals. These things are amazing, chef-crafted, always fresh, never frozen. All you do is heat them up and you're ready to go. No prepping, cooking, or cleanup, and you get something healthy, nutritious, and tasty. I love Factor meals, especially on those days when I'm in the office. They're better for me than snacks or junk food, and much cheaper and faster than buying my lunch at a restaurant. You can choose options like Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, Keto, and you can change your schedule to get as much or as little as you need every week, whatever suits you and your family best. Head to factormeals.com/literature50 and use code literature50 to get 50% off. That's code literature50 at factormeals.com/literature50 to get 50% off. Hey, grown-ups, the Cat in the Hat cast is a new podcast from Wondery, perfect for the whole family. Join the Cat in the Hat and your favorite Dr. Seuss characters as they get whisked away on a new adventure every week. Fish dreams of creating his very own polite and quiet podcast. That is, until he gets a surprise visit to his Fishbowl podcast studio from the Cat in the Hat himself, and it becomes very clear that the cat has other plans for the podcast, and those plans are the opposite of quiet. The cat may be disruptive, but it turns out he's also a great help to get Fish out of all kinds of predicaments. Bursting with music, silliness, and rhymes, the Cat in the Hat cast encourages us all to find fun that is funny in every episode. Sing along to new favorite songs, try your luck at Titanic tongue twisters, have some fun with wondrous wordplay, and most importantly, bring your family along for all of the adventures in the Cat in the Hat cast. Follow the Cat in the Hat cast on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to the Cat in the Hat cast ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts. Okay, joining me now is Gabriele Peduya, who is a professor of Italian literature at the University of Roma Tre and has been visiting professor at numerous universities, including UCLA, Princeton, Stanford, and Berkeley. He's here today to discuss his book on Niccolo Machiavelli, The Bonds of Politics. Gabriele Peduya, welcome to the History of Literature.
Thank you for this invitation. I feel very honored.
Okay, so I wanted to start with the question, who was Machiavelli? And I noticed that your book starts with the same question, but I want to take a little pressure off of you by saying that your next sentence begins, even today, scholars do not agree, ... And so let's hear from you, who was Machiavelli, with the understanding that there are some differences that we need to sort through here.
Yes, maybe we could start saying that we know who Machiavelli was from a cultural point of view, and we know who Machiavelli was from a professional point of view. I mean, he was raised as a humanist. I mean, he read a lot of Roman authors and a lot of Greek authors in Latin translation. So this is very important to see where he came from, culturally speaking.
Yeah.
But on the other side, he was a sort of civil servant. He worked for the Florentine Republic, and that was his profession for 14 years. Then the Medici, the famous family, came back to Florence, and he lost position, and he never regained a public position. He was very, what can I say, esteemed as an expert of political and military affairs. So that could be the first answer. I mean, just to see where he came from. On the other side, we read Machiavelli because he's probably one of the greatest political thinkers in Western history. So this is the contentious aspect of his work and his legacy, because we scholars are still discussing who Machiavelli was, and even more than what happens normally with the great classics. I mean, you have a huge scholarship on Plato or Aristotle, Locke, Hume, Rousseau. I mean, that happens because they are classics, of course, and we still read them and we discover new things. But in Machiavelli's case, I will say that the gap is much wider. I mean, you can really see opposite interpretations.
Right. Okay. So let's go through some more biographical facts that aren't in dispute before we get to the contentiousness among scholars about who he was and what he represents. So, I mean, what kind of life did he live? Was he married, or what do we know about kind of his day-to-day world?
He was the son of a lawyer who could never practice his profession because Machiavelli's grandfather was illegitimate. And that meant that he couldn't have a place in Florentine magistratures. I mean, he couldn't not be elected to any position on one side. And on the other side, it meant that Machiavelli and Machiavelli's father could not be part of one of the guilds.
Yeah, right.
That somehow ruled all the economic activities in Florence. So he was a bit of an outcast, you can say that.
Yeah.
And he got married, yes, at a certain point of his life. He traveled a lot because he was sort of an informal ambassador. So he went to France. He visited the emperor in northern Italy. And he went through Switzerland. So plus a lot of different places, central, northern Italy. I mean, he knew a wider part of the world, not just Tuscany and Florence.
Mm-hmm. And we call it Italy, but it's really pre-Italy, I guess, or Italy as we understand it today. What was going on there? How were the cities organized, and were they at war with one another? And what exactly was happening during his lifetime?
Exactly. During the 15th century, when Machiavelli was a child, there was a dramatic change in Europe because the great European monarchies consolidated in powerful states. I mean, this is what happened in England. This is what happened in France and Spain. I mean, you can see the same process. But that didn't happen in Germany, because in Italy you had the strong papal states, plus four other medium-sized powers, the Duchy of Milan, the Republic of Venice, the Republic of Florence, and the Kingdom of Naples. Okay, these five powers were very balanced during the 15th century. And at that time, Italy was really wealthy. And Italy enjoyed a long period of peace. But at the end of the 15th century, the French king, Charles VIII, moved to Italy because he wanted to be king of southern Italy, basically. And he destroyed this balance. And all of a sudden, the Italians discover that they were not that lucky and that they were really imperiled by the situation because they thought that their size was the normal size of political power. But if you compare, I don't know, Florence population to France population at the beginning of the 16th century, you can see that the difference is wider than the difference between Italy's population or France population and China's population today. It's really huge. I mean, no Italian power could compete with these European powers. And Italy was so wealthy that everyone wanted to take a part of it, basically. So at that point, the so-called Guerre d'Italia, in French, Le Guerre d'Italie, the wars of Italy started. I mean, every European power wanted to take advantage of this situation. And the fight for hegemony in Europe was fought on the Italian battlefields. And so it was a moment of crisis. I mean, the Italians thought we are the best. We are so accomplished from a cultural point of view. We are so wealthy. Our military system is just great. We have found a way to solve our problems through diplomacy instead than fighting annual wars. And then the King of France came to Italy and this balance was destroyed. And the Italians discovered that they were in such a bad situation instead. And this shock is the origin of Machiavelli's political theory.
Yeah. So you've said a couple of things that seem like they feed right into his project. And one of them was kind of one I hadn't thought about before. But the one that you just mentioned seems like it's very important, or must have been, which is that Italy is vulnerable. And he's seeing a place that previously thought it wasn't as vulnerable to now suddenly be exposed to danger and to kind of a being overwhelmed politically. And he seems like his project was to say, well, you want to stand on principles and fight fair and be gentlemen and all of that. But actually, the real world is a lot harsher than that. And you need to figure out an alternative to what you're doing in order to be effective.
Exactly, exactly. And I think that this is the reason why Machiavelli, who was raised as a humanist, became so harsh toward his mentors and intellectual teachers, because he thought that humanists insist too much on the relationship between pedagogy and politics. The idea was that if you can teach the future princes, the rulers to be, you can have a better world, which is true probably. But Machiavelli said this is not enough. I mean, this is not enough because we need to prepare the rulers, and both the Republican rulers and the princely rulers, for a different situation when you basically have to fight your enemies on the battlefield. And he said that probably humanism contributed to the weakness of Italian states and rulers. And so you can see how somebody who was really a son of humanism became a renegade son of humanism and went for a different solution.
I was wondering if you thought that one of the reasons why he was so well positioned to take that position or could adopt that frame of mind was because of the way his father was treated and his grandfather. It sounds like his father was perfectly capable, but was denied having a role in the guilds. Maybe such a person would look at the world and say, well, there's this surface where everything is supposed to be one way, but then there's a reality, the way people really treat one another. And that's as important as, or more important and more central to understanding what's going on than a kind of idealized version where the educated would be able to rise to the top, for example.
Thank you for this question, because this is really important in my view. This is part of my interpretation, in fact, of Machiavelli's personality. I mean, he was really an outcast in Florence. And that gave him the feeling that the shared truths are not always acceptable. And he started contesting them and started questioning them. And this is the reason why he was such an innovator, I would say. Mm. Because he loved to say, I write this against the opinion of so many authors.
Yeah.
I mean, this is really interesting because he wanted to be controversial somehow. He never tried to make easier to accept his position. And this is probably the reason why he's still so controversial, because he wanted to be that. Because he didn't accept the majority of the ideas of his time. For instance, he had a huge animosity against the people who Machiavelli calls the grandi, the mighty, the powerful, because he thought that the idea of an aristocracy is completely illegitimate. There must be a connection with the fact that he was such a gifted child, but he knew that he couldn't be a member of the Republic because he was still considered the legitimate grandson of an illegitimate man. So this is really an important point, I think.
Yeah. So it kind of comes down to the big point of contention where some scholars would say he's diabolical and he's encouraging everyone to be their worst self and to adopt things that seem counterintuitive and are more based on getting results than on treating people fairly or doing the right thing and so on. But someone on the other side would say he's just describing men as they are, and this is how the world works and this is how people really are, and he's just taking advantage of seeing things with clear eyes and not trying to pretend that the world is different from how it is. So where do you think he was in that? Was he aware that this was what he was doing, and can we take a position on that, or is it something that we're forever going to debate?
Machiavelli's attitude is the result of this big shock of the Italian Wars.
Mm.
Because Machiavelli started thinking that maybe traditional solutions were useless.
Mm.
And so he wanted to be effective, but it is very important that every time he could express his vision of Florentine politics, for instance, he went for the most popular form of government. I mean, he constantly had that in mind, the common good of the citizen. But on the other side, he knew that he had to invent something different and that the traditional education was not enough. So he wanted to be really effective. And this is the reason why he devoted so much attention to the tools of politics, the instruments you can use to make, for instance, people more respectful of the law and less ingrate. I mean, he thought that, for instance, the traditional insistence on love and mutual love between the ruler and his subjects doesn't work. Why? It doesn't work because you cannot impose love. Instead, you can impose fear. And this is the reason why fear works better. Because as long as people fear you or fear the institutions or fear the laws, they behave in a better way. And I will say that the big issue with Machiavelli is how to oblige people to be virtuous, which is, as you can see, one of the biggest problems of political philosophy. But this is the reason why I wanted to use this subtitle for my book, The Bonds of Politics. Mm. Because one of the core ideas of Machiavelli is the problem of bonding people together. How can make them work toward a social goal? How can I win their support for wider aims instead of just self-interest? Mm. Okay, Machiavelli thought that you can use self-interest in order to make the state stronger, the community stronger, the republic stronger. So he was using the sickness, you can say that probably, Machiavelli used a lot of medical metaphors. You can use the sickness as a therapy. So if the sickness is self-interest, you can use self-interest in order to make the common good stronger.
So it sounds like you would take the position that we can judge him by his goals, and you think his goals were generally good ones to have.
Mm-hmm. I would say so, yes. I would say so. I think that Machiavelli was a committed Republican, and I think that when in the prince, he decided to give some counsels to the Medici, he was just trying to save his main reform, because Machiavelli was famous in Italy for his popular militia. Under the Republic, he wanted to change the way Florence used to fight against the Florence and also the other Italian states used to fight in war, and he started organizing a popular army for the first time. So it was a big change. And when the Medici came to Florence, he wanted to sell his idea to them. But the interesting thing is that in the Prince, he clearly says that if you arm the people, you have to give them something. So he was looking for a sort of new balance, and he was trying to save whatever he could save from the Republic, even after its fall.
Okay, let's take a quick break and come back with more on Machiavelli. Okay, we're back. So, Gabriele, let's talk a little bit about how he was able to communicate his ideas. And you call him one of the great writers of Italian literature. I was wondering if you can tell us what the characteristics are of his style, or what earns him that position as one of the great writers of Italian literature.
Machiavelli was also a poet. Not a great poet, but he was a great playwright.
Mm.
His work, The Mandrake, is still in the repertoire in Italy and also in the U.S. Mandrake is extremely fun and probably the greatest Italian comedy before Goldoni and Pirandello. Mm-hmm. He's really at the center of the Italian canon from this point of view. But more generally speaking, Machiavelli is a great writer. I mean, his prose is just great. Sometimes he's not as polished as other classicists, Italian writer of the Renaissance, but he was so gifted. For instance, he was just great with his metaphors. I mean, he uses a lot of metaphors in his political writings. And they are so original on one side and vivid on the other side. I don't know, I can just to mention some examples, the idea that there are some banks of virtue which can stop the river of fortune, or the infamous idea that fortune is a woman and for this reason, you can beat her. Very problematic today.
Yeah.
But the image is very strong, or the ideal teacher of the rulers is a centaur, because the centaur is half beast and half man, and you have to have both of them, because you can be ready to fight the battlefield, and you have to learn something else, not just the humanities, but you have to be a military commander,
right,
if you want to survive.
Right.
So from this point of view, I mean, he was just great. He knew how to communicate his ideas. And another aspect, probably, let me mention just another aspect. Machiavelli knew how to shape his thoughts in magnificent sentences. I mean, they are really memorable. And you can decide to carve them in the stone, in the marble.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
And this was also a problem, because sometimes people cite a single sentence because the sentence is so beautiful, so memorable, and they forget the context. And this is the reason why Machiavelli was used to say things that were very far from his thoughts. Because, I mean, if you take just a sentence in a more complex argument, that this is really easy to misunderstand the general meaning of the paragraph.
Right. And is the prince taught in schools? Is he widely read? Is it the sort of thing that someone might pick up and read on the train and so on? Is it that common, or is it more of a interest among specialists?
No. The prince is taught in Italy in high school. I would say that both in philosophy and in Italian literature, and also in history. But I imagine that students read just some excerpts from Prince, because Machiavelli's language is difficult today. I mean, it is easier to read Machiavelli in translation than in Italian.
So what do you hope that your book will do? How is it different from other biographies or studies of Machiavelli, and what are you hoping people will take away from it?
When I finished writing the first draft of my book, I reread a few short books on Machiavelli, because I wanted to see what I did, basically. Maybe I forgot something. I discovered how far my book is from the previous books on Machiavelli. From many points of view, I was really surprised. And
yeah.
I will say, the first thing is I gave room in my manuscript to Machiavelli's other important works, like The Mandrake, but also The Art of War, his military dialogue, and his Florentine histories, which is a history of Florence since its foundation. I will say that I gave a lot of importance to literary genre.
Yeah.
Probably because I'm a literary scholar, but I knew that during the Renaissance, this was the basic questions. What are you doing? When you started a tract or a poem, there were many possibilities, and authors knew that they can do things in one way or in another way, but they had to choose at the beginning. And the interesting thing is that Machiavelli reworked very originally the literary genre of his time. So it is very important to see his relationship with them, but also the way he was an innovator. And finally, I will say that I wanted to highlight the importance of Machiavelli's reception. I mean, we have such a changing author. There are so many interpretations of Machiavelli.
Yeah, right.
They were very important for the effects they had, historically speaking. So you cannot just say, okay, I know who the real Machiavelli is. I mean, you can do that, but I was also interested in his reception, because I thought that even misreading was very important in this case. And Machiavelli was interpreted, of course, but he was also used. And I was interested in the many ways he was used. And I think that readers should be, because you can see how every important turning point in Western history, there was somebody who said, okay, I know the answer because I read Machiavelli.
Yeah.
Follow me.
Right.
Follow me. The American founding fathers read Machiavelli, and they were inspired by his reading, and they used many of his ideas from the Discourses on Liberty in the American Constitution. I mean, this is just one of the many examples. I mean, we could go on the other side and discuss how much relevant Machiavelli was for Mussolini, for Stalin. Okay, so this is really interesting. This is another history, and I wanted to tell it.
Right. So I guess on the reason why it could be used by very different types of leaders is, on the one hand, you would have someone who would say, well, this is sort of a guidebook. This will help me manipulate people and do things in a ruthless way. And on the other side, you would have people who would say, well, this is giving us something. It's a cautionary tale. It's telling us what people would do if they could be this ruthless, or if we let them be. So we need to put in some safeguards to make sure that we don't have something like that comes to power.
I would say that the biggest difference comes from the fact that you can either focus on the Prince or on the Discourses. The Prince is the book about the new power. I mean, mm-hmm. one of the most used expression in the Prince is the new Prince, the idea that things are changing, and then that you have to use different instruments in this very special situation. And in the Prince, Machiavelli gives harsh suggestions to his readers. He knows that you should use violence, for instance, to found a new political power. Mm-hmm. But then on the other side, you have the Discourses on Liberty. And in the Discourses on Liberty, he uses the same categories, but in order to see how a republic works and how you can make freedom possible. And his answer is that you should find an institutional system where no magistrate, no officer is completely free to act. You need checks and balances, basically. So the interesting thing is that Machiavelli gives two opposite suggestions. In the Prince, you have to be somehow alone because you are building a new power. And in the constituent moment, you cannot share the power because otherwise you won't be able to found a new state, a new powerful state. In the Discourses, he works on the other side. I mean, he's interested in the everyday functioning of the institutions. And this is the reason why this, can I say, Republican, even Democratic, sometimes tradition, Machiavelli was so relevant, because he gave a sort of blueprint for future constitutions. Hmm. On the other side, if you look at the Prince, you can just see the most superficial level and say, okay, I can learn some rules of expediency. And this is the Machiavelli Mussolini and Stalin loved.
Right. So when you look at today's politics and politicians, do you hope that they're reading Machiavelli? Or does that make you concerned when you hear that they are? Or does it matter what book they're reading, if it's The Prince or The Discourses on Livy?
I think that it is always a good thing reading Machiavelli, but I will suggest to print on the cover, handle with care.
Right.
I mean, Machiavelli was a fan of big politics. In his view, politicians and states should imitate only the highest model, like Rome or famous and admired rulers, for instance, Romulus or Cyrus or Moses. And this eulogy for great goals and great projects, combined with his idea that threat times call for desperate measures, can produce both admirable and very dangerous effects. So I see Machiavelli can be dangerous, yes, but Machiavelli can be so inspiring and so precious to us. I believe in his good faith in the end.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's leave things there. Gabriele Pedula, thank you so much for joining me on the History of Literature.
Thank you. It was such a pleasure.
That was Gabriele Pedula. I am so sorry for mispronouncing his name earlier. It's hard to shake that habit of the double L. Anyway, Gabriele Pedula, check out his book. So, finally today, we are visited by Sarah Rudin after she and I discussed the life and works of the ancient Roman poet Virgil. I asked her this special question. Okay, my guest is Sarah Rudin, author of the book Virgil, The Poet's Life. Sarah, this question comes from a listener who asks, what do you want your last book to be? This will be the last book you will ever read. You can either choose one that exists or describe one that has not yet been written.
Well, it would be Virginia Woolf's The Waves. Because I really need to choose a book in my own language.
Uh-huh.
That is a book that I can most deeply understand.
Yeah.
The book whose sounds with which I'm most at home.
Uh-huh.
And it is Virginia Woolf's The Waves. I don't think there is a more beautiful or more meaningful book in English literature.
Yeah. That's so interesting that you say it has to be in your language because you've spent so much time translating things from other languages.
Right. But I translate strictly from ancient languages into English. Now, as a grad student, I had practice translating into Latin and into Greek. And I know that that's for anyone less than an unimaginable genius. That's really impossible and pointless, too. English is the language in which I am comfortable.
Right.
So it's the language in which I'm at home. I think it is the greatest language there has ever been. Incredibly complex language, an incredibly beautiful language, a language in which you can sort of do more than in any other language. I'm sorry, I don't want to sound jingoistic.
Yeah, well, if we're talking about Virginia Woolf's English especially, it's hard to disagree.
Right, yeah. I worship her.
Okay, well, we have this tradition here at the History of Literature that whenever anyone mentions Virginia Woolf, we just let that be the last word. So we'll sign off there. Sarah Rudin, thank you so much for joining me on the History of Literature.
Thank you, intern.
Okay, there we go. That's going to do it for this episode of the History of Literature. I hope you enjoyed it. Doesn't it make you want to go visit Italy? I'll confess, I was on a hotel website checking out places, even though I'm not headed there anytime soon. Alas, it is enough to dream. What a life. That's my life now. 4 movies and some imaginary travels and podcasting, of course. Always podcasting. Speaking of which, we have Mike Palindrome coming up and some stories and storytelling and Knausgård. And another forgotten woman of literature. We'll head back to that series. Episode 600 is coming up soon, so we'll check that one off our list with one of our old faves. I hope you subscribe or follow or do whatever you do on your favorite podcasting app to make sure the shows all download and are waiting for you wherever you are, whenever you want. I'm Jack Wilson. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.